Okay, the topic of today's lecture is history and new directions for Austrian economists. Well, we've already pretty much covered the history. What I'd like to do is use the opportunity to present some research, some of my more current research on deflation, okay? And I think this is a new direction for Austrian economists. Up until very recently, Austrians, even Mises and Rothbard, have opposed certain types of deflation, okay? The mainstream, on the other hand, has and been in favor of other types. Let me state that. But the mainstream, especially since World War II, has been unalterably opposed to all types of deflation, okay? So but that's beginning to change now. In fact, let me start by just drawing your attention to an article that just came out in the AER. Let me see if I have a copy of it. And I wrote a little report on this article that is the Mises Daily article today on deflation and depression, where's the link? It used to be accepted as gospel truth that deflation caused depression. Okay, once again, since the onset of the Keynesian Revolution. But now economists are starting to look again at that link. And some of them, okay, even some Federal Reserve banks, have pointed out that some types of deflation are benevolent or good, okay, or benign. And other types continue to be, according to them, malevolent. One of the reasons that they're reassessing their view on deflation and its impact on the economic activity and on social welfare is because China has been going through what's called a growth deflation right now, in which there's been a fall in prices over the last few years, year after year, and that's coexisting with a very high rate of growth. Okay, so it's called a growth deflation. So there are two Federal Reserve regional banks in their reviews, two of the better ones, the Cleveland Federal Reserve Bank and the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, have now tried to distinguish between growth deflation, deflation that's caused by increases in the productivity of the economy, on the one hand, and deflation that is caused by other forces that they consider to be malevolent. So I think it was the St. Louis Fed recently attempted to distinguish between the sort of the Chinese deflation, which they thought was a good growth deflation, and the Japanese deflation. No, that isn't really even a deflation. It's just that the prices are rising at very low levels, which they call the corrosive deflation. But in any case, there's to get to the article that I'm talking about, two economists associated with the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, another of the more or less enlightened regional Federal Reserve banks. Their names are Atkison and Keough. Atkison teaches, they have impeccable mainstream credentials. Atkison teaches at UCLA, he's on the faculty there. And Keough is in the research department of the Minneapolis Fed and is also associated with the faculty of the University of Minnesota, which are very highly ranked economics programs, both UCLA and University of Minnesota. And what they did was they took 17 countries and they divided up their history, their economic history, for some countries going back to 1820, into five-year periods. And they called each of these periods an episode. And some of the countries included the U.S., Germany, Great Britain, France, and so on. And what they did then was to compare, run a very simple regression of the inflation rate. Now, in this study, deflation was defined as a negative inflation rate. Okay, so they took the average inflation rate, and if it was negative, for the five-year period or episode, they would then say there was deflation if it was negative. And they also took the growth rate. So a negative inflation rate was called deflation in the study, and a negative growth rate, that is, if the growth rate averaged over the 5 years was negative, they would call it a depression. And it was the years also, by the way, were picked to begin or end with the years 4 or 9. Now, the reason why they did that was so that they could include the Great Depression, or the worst part of the Great Depression, in one episode. And also another severe depression suffered by the U.S. from 1921-1922. That was included in an episode. Okay. And the regression was very simple. What they did was that they regressed the growth rate. Okay, that was the dependent variable on the inflation rate and a constant. Okay, it was a simple statistical correlation was really all it was. And so first they just focused, they reported on what they found for the Great Depression, from the episode that encompassed the Great Depression, what they call the Great Depression. Okay, they had 16 countries for which data were available, and even though all of these 16 countries during that five-year period experienced deflation, only half of them had a depression. Okay, and that's the worst episode of all the episodes that they reported on. Okay, and basically they found that overall for all countries, there was a 1 percentage point reduction in inflation was associated with a 0.4 percentage point reduction in output growth. Okay, and it was statistically significant. There was some weak link, a very weak link, even in the depression period between deflation and depression. Okay, but then they went on and they took all episodes, okay, over all the 17 countries, going back up to 100 years, or over 100 years for all countries. Okay, and some going back to 1820, as I said, and in that case, what they found out was that there were 73 episodes of deflation. Okay, so let me just put that in a little box for you. Deflation and depression. So excluding that one episode of the Great Depression for 16 countries, there were 73 deflation episodes. And interestingly enough, only 65 of those episodes had a depression, okay? I'm sorry, the other way around. Only 8 of those episodes had a depression, okay? So that's what they found there. They also found that there were 29 depression episodes, okay? And 21 of those were not associated with deflation, okay? So there were 29 depression episodes, again, only 8 were associated with deflation. And so they point out, they say, in other words, and I'm quoting them, 90% of deflation episodes, that's 65, did not culminate in depression, okay? Actually, that was my statement, not now quoting the authors. In a broader historical context, beyond the Great Depression, the notion that deflation and depression are linked virtually disappears, okay? And then they go on to all episodes. Now they take all episodes, including the Great Depression, and when they took all episodes, they found, again, a very, very weak link between the two. Just to give you an example, what they found was that for every 1% reduction in the growth rate, okay, so for every 1% decrease in deflation, let's say, the effect on this is the inflation rate. The effect on the growth rate was 0.08 percentage points. Now, what does that mean? That means if an economy is growing initially at 3% per year, okay, that's the rate of growth. That's about the normal rate of growth for the U.S. economy. It would take about if you took 30% deflation, okay, multiply that times 0.08, And what you would get is a reduction in this growth rate to 0.60%. Okay. Meaning this, that even though it might be statistically significant, you would have to have a massive deflation, and you wouldn't even get a depression with a massive deflation starting off from a normal growth rate. It would still be a slightly positive growth rate. So, though there is some link, it's extremely weak. And since in the first, during this period, from 1929 to 1934, deflation was only 5% per year, there's no way that a 5% change in, or a 5% per year deflation can explain the tremendous shrinkage of the economy. You know, the 25% reduction in the growth rate over those years, okay? Because 5% wouldn't even cause the, and since the economy was growing in the 1920s at 5 and 6% per year, it wouldn't even lower the growth rate by 1%. So let me just read you the conclusions of this study. Okay, so these two very mainstream economists conclude, the data suggests that deflation is not closely related to depressions. A broad historical look finds more periods of deflation with reasonable growth, okay, than with depression. And many more periods of depression with inflation than deflation. So you have 21, obviously, that had were associated with inflation, and only 8 with deflation. Okay. So they go on to say, overall, the data show virtually no link between deflation and depression. Now, this is a they do caution readers. They say, look, this is simple. We're simply looking at the raw data. We haven't employed any sophisticated econometric methods to tease out, more sophisticated conclusions, okay, about the link between deflation and depression. Now, they're not even talking about causality here at all. They're just talking about a pure empirical relationship between these two events, depression and deflation. And this empirical relationship was taken for granted. Okay, of course, yes, you know, most of the times in history when you have deflation, you have depression. But from their study, that's certainly not true. And so they do apologize. They say, well, maybe more sophisticated methods can bring, can give us greater insight into the link between the two. But in fact, from the Austrian point of view, as Murray Rothbard has always argued, the closer you are to the raw data, the better it is. Because it's the raw data, the actual prices, that are unaveraged, unsmoothed, unmanipulated, that are the unique outcome of the interaction of individual human beings on markets. So this is, for the Austrians, this is a strong study, okay? Precisely because there aren't sophisticated econometric techniques used to massage the data and so on. So what we, now, does this prove the Austrian theory in some way is correct? No, it doesn't. But it is illustrative, okay? It does illustrate something. It illustrates that deflation is perfectly consistent with a healthy, growing economy, on the one hand. And it also illustrates another point that's made by Austrians, that depression is not necessarily associated with deflation. Now, it doesn't prove the Austrian theory that you have to have a business cycle, you must first have inflation, and it's inflation that, by distorting interest rates and causing entrepreneurs to invest in higher order goods at the expense of lower order and consumer goods, that brings about the later recession. Okay, so this study doesn't prove any sort of causality, nor do they pretend that they do. Okay, on the other hand, it does cause the Friedman view. It does cause problems for Friedman's view. Okay, Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz wrote a very famous book almost exactly 40 years ago. It appeared in print. It was called The Monetary History of the U.S. And interestingly enough, this book was a purely empirical book. The very first line of the book reads something like, this is a book about the U.S. money stock. Not about human beings, about the U.S. money stock. Okay. So it's a purely empirical book, and they use one country, the U.S., and their correlations are based on data that go from something like 1860, I believe I have it here, to 19, I'm sorry, 1857 to 1960. Okay. This study uses a much broader sample of data and a longer sample of data. So this spells serious problems for the Friedmanite explanation. And in fact, there was just a Festschrift for this book in the Cato Journal. Okay, Cato being a free market think tank in Washington. And in it, Friedman wrote, "The most controversial of our major themes, which is our attribution to the Federal Reserve of a major share of the responsibility for the 1929-1933 contraction, has become almost conventional wisdom." And he's right about that. Most economists now accept that the reason why the U.S. had a Great Depression was because of mistakes in monetary policy made by the Fed and exacerbated by the international gold standard. Right? But what this study shows us is that very few of depression episodes are linked with deflation. Okay, so it's back to the drawing board for Friedman. Okay. So that I wanted to start with that, and then talk a little bit more about the theoretical aspects of deflation, because I've done some work on this. And what I tried to do in an article I recently wrote on deflation, it's called "An Austrian Taxonomy of Deflation with Applications to the U.S., was to show that there are different types of deflation, and they have different effects on economic efficiency and consumer welfare. Okay, I classified deflation in four ways. Okay, and they're listed up here. The first three ways, for the most part, scare the bejesus out of mainstream economists. They're very now. This is changing with growth deflation, but they believe all of these deflations, types of deflation, have devastating effects for the economy. Okay, and yet they don't talk about confiscatory deflation. Okay, and confiscatory deflation, as I'll show you, involves a gross violation of property rights and causes tremendous distortions of the economy. And the latest one occurred in Argentina a few years ago. But in the case of this type of deflation, the IMF is behind it, mainstream economists are behind it. They call it austerity measures. Okay, and this is the good kind of deflation, according to them. But in fact, no one only Murray Rothbard, of anyone of, you know, of any economist that, you know, has written, has identified and pointed out the negative implications of this type of deflation for an economy. Okay. But when did deflation phobia start? This fear that has been expressed by economists, politicians, the press, that our economy, the U.S. economy, was on a precipice of deflation. Well, it all began in 1999 or so. We had a few months when the price level was had actually declined. That is when the inflation rate was actually negative. Just a few months in the middle of the summer of 1999. And beginning late in 1999, we began to get these hysterical articles, okay, worrying about deflation. Most of them were written initially by supply-siders, supposedly free-market economists. Okay. And let me just read you some of the interesting titles. They're very creepy and grisly, the titles. "The Deflation Monster Still Lives." Okay, it's one. "The Specter of Deflation." Okay. Third is "Deflation Boogeyman Haunts Fed." Another one is "The Greatest Threat Facing the U.S. Economy, Deflation." Another one is "Why We Should Fear Deflation." Okay. Another is "Deflation, Making Sure It Doesn't Happen Here." And "The Deflation Dilemma, To Be Concerned or Not to Be Concerned." Okay. Even the International Monetary Fund recently held a conference in 2003 or 2002 called "Should We Be Worried About Deflation?" Okay. Now, the Fed didn't take deflation too seriously in 1999-2000. But Alan Greenspan realized that after the occurrence of the recession in 2000, okay, we had a recession in 2000-2001, and the slow recovery that the U.S. economy was involved in, that it would be a good ploy to begin to scare the American people into allowing him to push interest rates down to what were 50-year lows, okay, historic lows, so that at the beginning of 2003, actually right at the end of 2002, he sent out one of his top economists, Ben Bernanke, to give a speech before a very prestigious conference of businessmen, okay? And in that speech, Bernanke more or less sounded the alarm about deflation. Now, Greenspan didn't weigh in until later on, okay? He's a very careful man. What he wanted to do was to see the response to the talk. But the talk itself is fairly scary. I mean, some of the things that Bernanke says in this talk, and if I let's read you a little bit of it, let's see. Actually, I don't really have the... Oh, yes, I do. I don't have it here, but what he basically says is the following. Bernanke says, he assures his audience that, in fact, the Fed has enough tools, even with the interest rate very low, even with the interest rate near zero, they still have many, many different tools with which to fight deflation, with which to prevent deflation. And he lists four or five of them. He says, look, we can just go into the market, and we don't just have to buy American government securities, okay? We can buy securities from Mexico. In other words, we can begin printing money and buying up the securities of foreign governments, okay? He says, or we can go into asset markets and we can begin building, buying stocks, for example, or physical assets. We can buy buildings. Whenever the Fed buys anything, of course, it creates money, okay? The scariest thing he says, though, is at the end, he says, in fact, he said, think of it this way. He said, if you had, if alchemy, changing a base metal like iron or lead into gold, actually worked, what would occur is that as consumers and markets found out that alchemy worked and that therefore the market would soon be flooded with gold, the price of gold would immediately fall tremendously. Its value would decline tremendously in anticipation. Okay? So he goes on to say, therefore, we don't have to worry about deflation because we do have a modern alchemy. He admits that the Fed is in some sense an alchemist. He said the Fed can announce tomorrow that they are going to use all their power simply to print up money and just flood the market with money. And he said, in that case, what would happen? He said people would rush out anticipating the Fed doing this. They would rush out and they would immediately start spending their cash balances, fearful that in a few weeks' time prices would go sky high. And he said, as a last resort, this is what we would do. He says, not only can we create inflation, in other words, he's saying, we can and will create inflationary expectations. And it's precisely inflationary expectations that causes hyperinflation. And other economists during the 90s, so we didn't hear much about it, other English-speaking economists, American economists, such as Krugman in particular, have been counseling Japan to do precisely this, okay? Not only to create money at a rapid rate, but to announce that they're gonna depreciate the yen by just flooding the market with yen, causing people to become scared, to become worried that their money's gonna be worth nothing, and this would end, according to Krugman, the Japanese deflation. So, now Bernanke is on the board of governors of the Fed, and he has been rumored to be an heir to Alan Greenspan when he steps down or dies or just rigidifies and never moves again. he looks like he's slowing down to me. That's truly scary, okay, that a governor of the Fed would make that statement. All right, now that was in November of 2003. Then in April or so, there was a slight downturn in retail sales, April 2003, and then maybe there was a fall in producers' prices. It was just a small tick down, okay? So this is where Greenspan jumped in as the great crusader against deflation. And he said something like, a further reduction in the rate of inflation, not even deflation, but a further reduction in the rate of inflation would be unwelcome. That's all he said. And the markets panicked immediately, because they hang on every word that Alan Greenspan utters. And what everyone immediately began saying, oh, you know, deflation's right around the corner. Okay, they read that into his remarks. Then, a few weeks later, I think it was in May, he spoke before Congress, and he said, we will do everything. Once he created hysteria and the panic, of course, and he waited a few weeks, let it grow. Then he went before Congress, and he said, the Fed has more than enough tools, even with low interest rates, to fight deflation. And he lowered the interest rate more, and you know, he talked about, he used the word, we have alternative means. And so for weeks, journalists were trying to figure out what these alternative means were, what the alternative weapons the Fed had, and all this other nonsense. Okay. Okay. So that's what started the deflation phobia. Now, Mark Thornton had fear of falling prices translated into Greek, and because it always sounds better when you sort of have a Greek or Latin name for some sort of phobia. And I can't. I think it was apophistomo. Yeah, pop. Say it again. Yeah. Okay. So now we have a word to define what Greenspan is. Okay. So now let me talk about whether, in fact, deflation is a problem, if we have it, and then I'll just say a few words at the end whether we were ever near having a deflation. The hysteria is over now, and now they are again talking about the possibility of the return of inflation, and they should be because they've been increasing the money supply at very rapid rates since 2001 or so. So let me then begin with defining deflation. Okay, let me remind you that if you are familiar with Austrian economics, that prior to World War II. Or prior to the Keynesian Revolution, inflation and deflation referred to a volume, okay, and a volume of money. Okay, inflation was if you inflated something, you increased the volume of that thing. Okay, if you deflated something like a balloon, you decreased the volume. It never meant a level. Okay, when the word was used then, it meant an increase in the volume of money. Some economists use it to mean an increase in the volume of money beyond the amount of gold in the economy. Okay. But in any case, it always referred to the volume of money. It was only after the Keynesian Revolution that the word deflation began to be applied not to the quantity of money in the economy, but in fact to the price level. Whereas older economists would point to the price level and say, well, that's one of the effects of inflation. Okay, that isn't it. It's one of the effects. Now, using or restricting the use of the word of inflation or deflation to the money supply then directs your attention to the results or the consequences. Okay? Only one of which may be an increase in prices. But once you talk about inflation as referring simply to the level, okay, of prices, then as Mises points out in Human Action, your attention is diverted from other effects of increasing the money supply, such as pushing the interest rate down, distorting the structure of production, and so on. However, I will use these terms in the more modern sense of a change in the price level. But even here, economists go wrong. For example, when they talk about inflation or deflation, let's say Greenspan, he might say, or he might predict that we're going to have inflation because let's say the prices of raw materials and producer goods are going up. So he'll focus, and supply siders do this also. They focus on not consumer goods, the price of consumer goods, but on the prices of what are supposedly the costs of producing consumer goods. And they say that over time, the increase in costs will work their way through the economy and push prices up. Okay. Well, that's completely wrong because that's a cost of production theory of value and of price, okay, which Austrians reject. But secondly, as Menger pointed out, the end of any economy is the production of consumer goods. So it's the prices of consumer goods that we should be concerned with when we're talking about inflation and deflation, right? They are the ultimate output of the economy. So when I talk about deflation or inflation from now on, I'll be talking about consumer goods prices. Okay, now let's talk about deflation, good and bad. Remember, deflation is simply another word for an increase in the value of money. Actually, that used to be the way increase in price referred to. Okay, a deflation of the money supply resulted in an increase in the value of money. Money became more scarce, and therefore its value increased. That was the law of supply and demand. Or in the case of inflation, an inflation of the money supply, or inflation, unqualified, resulted in a depreciation or a fall in the value of money. Okay. So now, what's so bad about an increase in the value of money? Why should we be worried if each of our dollars can buy more goods than it did at some previous time period? Okay, think of it that way. Well, you shouldn't be worried if the increase in the value of money results from the first three types of deflation. Let me start with growth deflation very quickly. Growth deflation is just what it says. It results when there is increased productivity in the economy due to improved technology and more saving and investment. Okay? These result in each laborer being more productive and therefore more goods per laborer being produced. Okay? No one worries about falling prices when it occurs in specific industries. In fact, we're happy when prices fall. And we're not very happy when prices go up, as in the case of gasoline, when the value of our dollar depreciates. Let me give you an example. Take the high-tech industries. A mainframe computer in 1970 sold for $4.7 million. Okay. Today, you can purchase a PC that's 20 times faster for less than $1,000. Right? No one complained about this massive deflation in the price of computers. In fact, the industries themselves flourished under these falling prices. So, to take a base here, 1980, computer firms shipped about 490,000 PCs, about 500,000. Okay. Now, by 1999, their shipments exceeded 43 million units, more than 86 times as much. And yet, prices fell by 90% in the meantime. But we know why this happened. What happened was technological improvements in the types of capital that were used and the amount of capital that was used in the industry allowed greater productivity. So that lowered costs. More computer firms came in. There was competition that drove prices down as costs fell. So, in fact, the firms that lowered their costs more than other firms were actually earning more profits than they were at the higher prices. If everyone is happy about falling prices in particular industries, well, what about the economy as a whole? Well, let's take a few examples here. For most of the 19th century and up until World War I, we had a mild deflationary trend. Prices throughout in the U.S. and also in Great Britain fell mildly. Give you a specific example. From 1880 to 1896, the wholesale price level fell by 30%. Okay, in 16 years, which works out to be near 2% per year. Okay, yet people's real income, the amount of real income they were receiving from industry, was increased by 85% or 5% per year. So while prices were falling by 2% per year, real income growth was 5% per year. Okay, illustrating one of these episodes where there's deflation, but there's very rapid growth. Recently in China, for the 4 years from 1998 to 2001, real GDP increased by 7.6% per year. It's a tremendous rate of growth. And prices fell between 1% and 3% in China for those 4 years. That was the average. Okay. They fell by no less than 0.8% and no more than 3%. So between that, those two figures. Okay. One last point about growth deflation. When you have growth deflation, when you have prices falling, does it mean that wages have to fall? No, nominal wages do not have to fall. Okay, the costs fall because each worker is more productive, is producing more goods. So nominal wages can stay the same, prices will fall, and real wages will therefore rise. Okay, so sound economics as well as common sense tells us that growth deflation is good. It results in the satisfaction of more human wants. We have more goods in the economy without having any less, and it results purely from voluntary exchange. So therefore, it maximizes, in some sense, in the Rothbardian sense, social utility. Okay. What about cash building deflation? Okay. Unfortunately, cash building deflation has had a bad name. The bad name is called hoarding, which has very negative connotations. Okay. Hoarding conjures up the image of some old mean miser, you know, in his bed, fondling all these gold coins at night, okay, and deriving direct pleasure from the money and never spending any of it, and therefore driving local retailers out of business and all this other nonsense. But in fact, if we get rid of that name, cash building deflation means that people, for whatever reason, want to increase the amount of their income or wealth that they devote to money, okay? So rather than holding consumer goods or durable consumer goods, or as many durable consumer goods, as many investments in stock and bonds, they want to hold more cash in proportion to their wealth and their income. Now, there might be a number of reasons for doing this. One might be increased uncertainty about the future. Okay, this happens during times of recession, but remember, recessions are government-made anyway. So if the governments want to discourage cash building deflation in a healthy way, they can refrain from a previous inflation that will lay the groundwork for the future depression. Because people do become more worried about losing jobs in the future. They become more worried about taking pay cuts. In general, they just become more anxious. And whenever people become more anxious about the future, they do tend to build up their cash balances. Okay, but it's a rational response. It's an efficient response to a future that has become more pessimistic. Okay, there's other cases of cash building can occur as the population grows, as the economy, and you get more people establishing families and so on, and going to work, and so the demand for the money supply increases for that reason. So as you get more people, which again is a healthy thing, you get an increase in demand for cash balances. That's a long-term increase in demand. But the cash building that results from insecurity and pessimism, that disappears pretty quickly when the recession's over. So that also does not violate property rights. It's a result of voluntary actions. It increases the real value of the money supply, because as prices fall, because people are holding more money and not spending it, prices fall, that means each dollar is worth more, which is precisely what people want. With the same amount of gold in the economy, you now have each gold ounce or each dollar's worth of gold purchasing more than it did before. Okay. Now, one point about cash building deflation that makes it more problematic, or I don't want to use the word problematic, but makes it more suspicious in the eyes of mainstream economists, is that this does involve a fall in nominal wage rates, okay? Because prices are falling, not because of increases in productivity, but because people are spending less. The demand for labor in nominal terms is going to fall, and laborers are going to have to take a nominal pay cut, but not necessarily a real pay cut. And it can lead to unemployment if and only if special privileges are given to unions or the government interferes with minimum wages. So even in that case, it's not the fault of the voluntary exchanges that result in the higher value of money, but it's a result of government not allowing this adjustment process, not allowing voluntary transactions in certain sectors of the market, the labor market to be specific. Okay. Finally, we'll come to bank credit deflation. What is called bank credit deflation typically comes about when depositors lose confidence in the banks. Bank credit deflation tended in the U.S. to occur before 1933, okay? Because by 1933, we had Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation being set up. Was that 35? In any case, it happened before 33 because the government had gone off the gold standard. The U.S. government had taken us off the gold standard by 1933. When people lose confidence in the banks, they rush to redeem their checking accounts and their savings accounts in cash, okay, in gold. And since historically the U.S. and most major industrial countries have had a classical gold standard under which that coexisted with fractional reserve banking, bank runs did result in massive bankruptcies, causing banks to go out of business, and therefore people's checking and savings accounts, at least the people that get there late, okay, after the gold runs out, their checking and savings accounts disappear into thin air. So it causes a collapse of the money supply. Okay. It can also be caused by banks, the more prudent banks, seeing what's coming, calling in their loans, okay, in gold, and not relending that gold, which means that the money supply shrinks for that reason. Okay, so you have a shrinkage, you do have a shrinkage of the money supply, and you do have less money in the economy. But once again, you have an increase in the value of money, and we can look to history to see has an increase in the value of money that's resulted from this always or frequently caused depressions. And one good example of this is the depression that the U.S. suffered in 1839. Okay, the Second Bank of the U.S. had inflated the U.S. money supply in the 1830s. Andrew Jackson had waged a war against this bank, which he eventually won, and it was abolished. The special privileges were taken away from the bank. But in the meantime, the bank did cause an inflation in the U.S. And if you look at from the peak of the business cycle, which was in 1839, okay, to the point where it reached its lowest point, which was in 1843, okay, when we were in the trough of the Depression, the money supply contracted by about 34%. So one-third of the money supply was simply wiped out, okay, as a result of bank runs and banks reducing their loans and so on. About one-quarter of the nation's banks collapsed, went out of business, 23%, including the Bank of the U.S., Bank of the United States that had initiated the whole thing. And wholesale prices fell during this time by 42%. So prices were almost cut in half. Okay, they don't really have information on consumers' goods prices, but wholesale prices are close enough to the consumer. However, now, here's what's interesting. The consumption during this period, during that 4 years from 1839 to 1843, consumption, so the change in consumption was plus 16%. Consumption went up during that period. There were more consumer goods produced in the economy, okay, despite this massive deflation. GNP, so a real output, okay, real output we'll call Y, went up by 16%. Consumption went up by 21%. Okay. The only real quantity that fell was investment. Okay. Investment, change in investment, the amount that firms were investing in terms of real resources, fell by 23%. But that's precisely what you want to happen during a recession, during an Austrian-style recession. Okay. It was an overinvestment in higher order goods, and the result was that when the recession hit, when the malinvestments were revealed, they were liquidated. But yet, because there were no unions, because wages and prices were permitted to fall, we didn't have any sort of a depression, okay, that in which is defined as a fall in overall real output. And what's interesting is that you can compare 1839 to 1843 with 1929 to 1934, and we find that in that case, the change in the money supply was almost exactly the same. The money supply shrunk here by about one-third, okay? And also the number of banks that went out of business were about the same. I think 25% of the banks went out of business. Maybe it was a little more than that. But in any case, this was very different, okay? We had a tremendous fall in real output in the second period, okay? And we had a tremendous fall in consumption as well as in investment. Now, the reason why, of course, was because there was a lot of intervention in labor markets and in other markets in the economy by the Hoover and then Roosevelt administrations. Okay? Without that intervention, bank credit deflation was benign, okay? Okay? Think of it in the following way. It was simply transferring resources from firms that people had lost confidence in to firms who had shown that they were trustworthy. And all economists, mainstream economists included, would agree that this is a good thing, this reallocation of resources. For example, any firm such as an armored car company or a law firm who trades on its trustworthiness, if and when its clients lose confidence that it's really representing their interests or acting in their interests, will certainly pull out of these firms and cause them to go bankrupt and shift their purchases to other firms. In fact, something that was very interesting happened back in the late 1980s. It was in a Wall Street Journal long article on it. There was an armored car company that was found to be lending out the deposits. Now, I thought armored car companies pick up the money and then you know, a few hours later deliver it to where it's supposed to go. But many times they warehouse the money for up to a week. And this company was somehow investing and speculating with people's money. Okay. And that firm was, of course, as soon as it was found out that, you know, people stopped using it, but it was also charged with fraud. Okay? Well, that's exactly what banks do, what fractional reserve banks do. Okay? But when an armored car company did it, it was considered straight out fraud. Okay? Okay, the final type of deflation, so all these types of deflation, I think, are good in, again, from the consumer's point of view. They're consistent with people voluntarily exchanging property titles. Okay, remember, even in the case of bank credit deflation, all people are trying to do there in a bank run is to reclaim their property. You have to keep in mind that it is gold that is money. The bank notes and bank deposits are simply titles to money. If firms multiply those titles to money, then they are producing false property titles. And when people come to claim their property, the inner contradiction of fractional banking comes to the fore, okay? And the thing collapses. I often give the example of to my MBA students of say there's a real estate and management company that is willing to build vacation homes in very, very remote areas, and also to furnish them and take care of them. And let's say they build them in, you know, the wilds of Montana and so on, and they begin to sell these homes to two people, okay, to two different families, unbeknownst to one another, okay? And assuming they know a little bit about these families, they figure, they'll figure out families that want to come up there in the summer and others that will come in the winter, okay? And so they sell the house, you know, fee simple to these two families. And now, we would call that fraud, but I'm not as interested in the justice aspects of it as I am in sort of the existential aspects of it. There would be effects on the market that would completely distort production, because if those houses weren't sold to two people, you would have different distribution of consumer spending. Okay, people would purchase other things. You would have a different distribution of income and so on. So multiplying property titles has real effects on the economy. And you can see it when you move away from money and you look at something like this. And I think all mainstream economists would agree that sort of behavior should be suppressed. Okay? That these are false property titles, the second title sold to the home. Okay. Now let's get to the confiscatory deflation. Confiscatory comes from confiscation. I know whenever I write this word, and my spell check comes up and says it's not a word, it's the wrong, you know, it's misspelled. I don't mean that, but it's Mises uses the term confiscatory taxation. That's where I got it from, and I don't know if Murray Rothbard actually used the term confiscatory deflation. I don't think he did in his article where he identified the concept. He didn't use that term. So I've derived the term, or I took the term from Mises when he talks about confiscatory taxation. I just call it confiscatory deflation. This does violate property rights. Okay, it does distort monetary calculation and it undermines monetary exchange. And it can even cause an economy to be catapulted back to barter. And that actually happened in Argentina. Let me just, now, Confiscatory deflation occurred a number of times in the 90s. It occurred in Brazil, actually in the 80s. It started in the former Soviet Union. For a while, the Soviet government, to prevent deflation, in a sense, froze 80% of bank deposits in Soviet banks. Okay, so it's not permitting people, confiscatory deflation, to use cash balances that they hold in banks, okay, or to force them to only, or not to permit them to take out the full amount of money that they hold in their deposits. Okay, I won't go into the Argentine example too much, except to say that it occurred because Argentina attempted to set the rate of its pesos. So pesos were equal, one peso was equal to $1. Okay, it attempted to peg the peso to the dollar. The IMF said, no, this is a good idea. Okay, so that for every, the supply of peso notes could only be increased in Argentina if a dollar was brought in or came into investment in the economy or through exporting. Okay, when that dollar came into the economy, the exporter or the local recipient of the investment would bring the dollar to the currency board, the Argentine currency board, in exchange would get a peso note or a peso deposit. Okay, now every peso note was backed up by a dollar, but there was still fractional reserve banking. So when the new peso notes got put into the banks, they were multiplied, and we had tremendous increases in the Argentine money supply. Okay, it increased at an average rate from 1991 through 1994 of 60% per year. Now, this is because when the IMF said it was a good idea, people believe, well, the U.S. is backing up the IMF, and therefore the U.S. is putting its imprimatur on this currency board arrangement, and that there's no risk. We'll get bailed out. Okay? So all this investment money flowed into Argentina. It got into the banking system, okay, these dollars, and it was multiplied, and it was a huge increase in the Argentine money supply. It slowed down for a while. It went to 5% in 1995 after increasing at 60% per year for 4 years. Then 15% in 1996, and then it went back up to 20%, the increase in money supply in 1997. So prices were rising tremendously in Argentina. The peso became overvalued, okay, because prices were so high. And eventually, the investors began to pull their money out of Argentina. And when they, because they became fearful. They became fearful that Argentina would have to devalue the peso, which they eventually did do. So in 1999, monetary growth turned slightly negative. And then 2000, in the year 2000, the money supply shrunk by 20% under this system. Okay. And so what did the Argentines, respond to this? In 2001, even domestic depositors began to lose confidence and began to take their money out of the banking system. And on Friday, November 30th, one day, $2 billion of deposits were withdrawn from Argentine banks. Now, what they had left then, and this is the classic problem with fractional reserve banking. I can't find my eraser here. Okay. They had something like $70 billion in peso and dollar deposits. Okay, they could accept dollar deposits. So you had checking account money worth $70 billion in pesos and dollars. And remember, one peso equaled $1. And there was $5.5 billion of reserves in the system. So if everyone tried to get their money out, of course, the whole thing would collapse. So instead of allowing that to happen, okay, and there are other, there was other alternatives there. Really, the banks were bankrupt. So, hand them up. I wrote up an article on this that was reprinted in an Indian Finance Journal of all places that said, "Give the banks to the people." In other words, give the banks to the depositors, prorate the amount of actual money in the banks among the depositors, and then for the rest, which were all out in the form of loans, turn that into a mutual fund and give depositors shares in the mutual fund. Okay, shares in those loans and investments that the bank had made with their money. So the money supply would collapse, okay, and prices would fall, but it would be a one-shot deal. Prices would fall. people would still have their savings. Their savings now would be in the form of mutual funds. They wouldn't be able to take it out instantaneously, or if they did, they would be selling these assets to other mutual funds. And you would get rid of the problem. But that's not what the Argentine government did. What the Argentine government did was to basically come up with all these rules about how people and when people could take and how much of their money people could take out of the various banks and so on. And let me just give you an idea of what this was like. On December 1st, the day after the bank run, the economy minister, his name was Cavallo, limited cash withdrawals from banks to $250 per depositor per week for the next 90 days, and all overseas cash transfers exceeding $1,000 were to be strictly regulated. Okay, anyone who wanted to carry cash out of the country by ship or by plane was interdicted by the authorities. Now that didn't affect too much. That didn't affect people, wealthier Argentines, because they had credit cards, so they could make their purchases with credit cards. They also had checking accounts. You were allowed to write checks, but the checks couldn't be cashed. Okay, you could write checks. But you could pay the seller, and then the balance in the bank would be credited to the seller. But no cash would come out of the banks beyond a very small amount. Unfortunately, lower income Argentines had these very, very small accounts, and it wasn't worth the bank's time and trouble to give them checks for those. So they had non-checkable accounts, so they couldn't make any purchases. So retail trade came to a standstill. Then the next the government fell. There were a number of riots. 27 lives were lost. Millions of dollars of damages to private businesses. So the next government to come in froze all savings accounts above $3,000 for a year. That affected about one third of the $70 billion of deposits left in the banking system. Okay. The depositors who held accounts not exceeding $5,000 would be able to withdraw their cash in 12 monthly installments starting 1 year from that time. And those with larger dollar deposits would not be able to begin cashing out until September of 2003. Okay. And then an installment spread over 2 years. So basically they confiscated people's cash balances. Okay. And the, Argentines themselves realized what was going on, and for example, a retired textile worker railed at an empty ATM machine. "That's my money inside that bank, mine." Another unidentified woman yelled at a government spokesman, "How dare you take my savings?" A salesman said, "It's as if while I'm talking to you, I'm swiping the change from your pocket," quote unquote. Finally, one Argentine businessman said, "It's trampling on our liberties. I feel my civic rights, my private rights have been violated." Even the Argentine unions, God bless them, said, denounced the policy as, quote, "hijacking of the nation's savings." Now, I predicted in the original article I wrote on this that this would lead to a demonetization of the economy. That is, that it was going to push the economy, or catapult the economy back toward barter. And in fact, a few months after I wrote this article, which appeared on Mises' web, the one on Argentina did, this is what happened. I'll end with this. By the end of 2002, so a full year after all this had occurred, or a year and a half after it had occurred, corn, soybeans, sunflowers, and wheat had reportedly become a preferred legal tender in Argentina, often more welcome than cash because they are priced in dollars. Automobile sales had fallen by 61% in 2002. Okay, why? Because it's very difficult to barter automobiles for things. So that rural dealerships began bartering for grain contracts, and they were called truques, I think, to stay afloat. Ford Motor Company, General Motors, and Toyota Motor implemented countrywide sales pitches and programs to teach their employees how to trade vehicles for grain. Okay? In Rosario, which is the grain capital of Argentina, the Ford dealership swapped 50 cars for grains in a 3-month period. Daimler Chrysler introduced quote, "grain plan," unquote, which permitted Argentine customers to use grain to purchase Mercedes-Benz, Chrysler Jeep, and Dodge vehicles. A farm equipment maker swapped $9.5 million worth of farm machinery for corn, sorghum, soybeans, and wheat, and bought Toyota pickup trucks for its fleet with some of the grain received. Now, they weren't actually trading the physical wheat. They were trading the receipts to the wheat. You know, the wheat was in the granaries. Which, of course, now what did the farmers do? Or even before the farm? Even a few insurance companies were considering plans to accept premiums in grain. Predictably, farmers began withholding some of their product, in effect treating grain hoarded in their silos as cash balances. This is one of my last sentence. Thus, 25% of the soybean crop went unsold in 2002 compared to only 10% the previous year. Okay? So this had a devastating effect on the Argentine economy, yet mainstream economists never criticize this type of deflation. Thank you.